Today is March 29, 2019, and my name is Deborah Schwartz, and I am sitting here in the Mill Valley Library Sound Room on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Public Library with the most amazing woman, Jackie Phelan, eco-pioneer, bike champion, and founder of Women's Mountain Bike and Tea Society, also known as Wombats. Jackie, thank you so much for taking the time to come sit with me in the rubber room here.
Thank you.
And to share your story. You're somewhat of a rarity to me because I've interviewed a lot of the founders of mountain biking, almost all men. In fact, 99% men. And their stories are wonderful, and the birth of mountain biking on Mount Tamalpais is remarkable. And I've yearned to hear more of the women's perspective. So I'm thrilled to have you here in the library. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Happy to unload.
Jackie, let's start with a little bit about your family, about your personal history, so we can get a little context as to what brought you here to Marin and where you were in those early years of mountain biking. Tell me, were you born and raised in Marin?
No, I wasn't. I was born in San Francisco, 1955, and my parents moved me, I was the oldest of their clan, to Rhode Island when I was 6 months old. So I spent 5 years there, then 5 years in Topeka, Kansas, and then about 5 years in Los Angeles before going to college in Vermont, but knew I wanted to get back to San Francisco because of all the great stuff that was going on in San Francisco and the fact that my parents really had wanted to settle and raise the family there, but because they couldn't wedge themselves into the psychoanalytic community up here, and they went to L.A. where there's a more of a growth market for neurotic people. And so I lived not exactly where Dad wanted us to be, and I yearned to get to the Bay Area, which is legendary for its embrace of people that would be called misfits elsewhere. And it's a very beautiful place with an amazing, amazing, rich artistic culture. So I'm a maven of that kind of lively community world. You could really I'm trying to figure out how to put it into words. Because I did not succeed in the become a doctor thing that I was supposedly raised, you know, going to do from the age of eight, and it just didn't work out because I'm not, essentially, I'm not a scientist. Plan B was hang out in the Bay Area and figure out what I want to do with my life. And I knew when I was crossing the Bay Bridge from a two-day drive from the East Coast that, you know, I'm going to make my fortune here. I felt, you know, a real nice cliche as we were going over.
You felt possibility.
I knew it. I was, you know, writing my own fantastic history. Just didn't know what it was going to be at all. No idea.
When you talk about the therapy aspect of your family, let's talk a little bit about your – let's go back a little to understand where your family came from. I mean, your – and include names if you can.
Sure.
Your grandparents, I mean, have you been in this – your family been in this country for a while?
Yeah, I think that most of the Phelans were at least third-generation Irish, Americans. And my mom's side are Canadian and Irish and English. My mom's Doreen Stevenson Phelan, and my dad is John Robert Phelan. He was actually born in Ross, but I didn't find that out until years after living in Marin County that he was actually born at the Ross Hospital. And that might sound a little odd, but I don't have strong family ties, and I definitely did not know my grandparents. My parents had nearly nothing to do with their parents, and so the six Phelan kids did not have the loving embrace of grandparents. So whenever I, you know, my friends tell me they're becoming grandparents, I'm really happy for them because they're going to get a chance to love these little kids and sort of close the life cycle, you know, mm-hmm. in a healthy way. But for the Phelans, it was sort of like life is a assembly line, or I don't know what you call it, that thing that goes to the edge and then you just drop off.
Mm-hmm. Were your parents eccentric? I mean, were they therapists?
They were mentally ill.
And, your parents were mentally
ill? Yeah, my dad was a psychoanalyst. Everybody knows that shrinks are crazy. And my mom, I mean, don't roll your eyes.
I'm just laughing. I know that's true. It's a cliche.
And my mom was pretty unwell. And these sorts of people seek each other out. Each had parents that were indifferent parenters themselves. And so they didn't know what it was like to be nurturing and loving. And so they worked out. And then they had kids and had no idea how to be with them. And I'm lucky I got 1 year of my mom's full attention, because right after that, she was like practically a single mom for five more very rapid succession children, whose names are Jill Kathleen Phelan. She lives in the East Bay. I haven't spoken to her in 40 years. I don't actually know her anymore.
This is the year right first, and then comes two, and that's your sister that
you
have spoken.
Yeah, she's a year younger than me, and then a year younger than her is Llewellyn Phelan, L-L-E-W-E-L-L-Y-N, and he's... essentially lives in a truck in the East Bay somewhere really far away from neighborhoods, because he's a registered sex offender. And I don't have anything to do with him, because he really manifests pretty unwell. And I can't really help him. And it's tragic. And I think of him a lot. And I think of my sister a lot. But they're not in my life. And so that's a heartbreaking element of my life history. And then the next two brothers are bachelors that live together in Wairika. One's a teetotaling bike mechanic who has a little shop, and the one that's 1 year younger than him.
And his name?
His name is Jonathan Phelan. Mm-hmm. And his younger brother, our younger brother, is Sean, who's been drunk his entire life ever since my mom took her life, and he blames himself for not rescuing her. And then the caboose kid is 5 years younger than all of us five. His name's Gregory, and he's a doctor. He's a neuroradiologist and lives in Minneapolis. So he's quite, conforming way, successful, and has children, that two boys that I'm sure he's got his challenges loving and raising, but at least he's doing it, and he's remained married to his wife and stuff. And we're in medium contact. Tentative and
so of your five other siblings,
I have the only contact really with him. Mm-hmm. The two bachelor brothers, I'm not, I haven't cut myself off or anything. They just don't reach out, and I don't reach out. But I, I wouldn't mind if they did. Anyway, so I guess the topic of family is very intense for me, because. The bicycle community has become my biological family, because I spend the most time with people that are in two-wheel culture and have sort of bonded with people whose families and siblings all seem to get along, because I want to be around that sort rather than the folks where you're not allowed to mention one or two names. And I found out many, many years later at one of my relatives' funerals that my father's father didn't allow his brother or my dad's uncle's name to be mentioned. My dad's father's name was Frank Ignatius Phelan, and he worked for the phone company. And I don't know what his brother's name is, but something set them off. And my sister for sure, like, cut everybody off. And in my cousin's family, one of those kids did that. And it's like, God, is it on the chromosomes?
Yeah, personality trait inherited.
Well, certainly the mental illness is inherited. And it's probably on the spectrum of dysfunctionality, emotive dysfunctionality. So
in a way, when you came to the Bay, you're a solo writer. I mean, you were...
Yeah, I was winging it, and I was not going to I tried applying for boring old office jobs, but you have to wear makeup and look a certain way. And so my first job ended up being a vet technician, because dogs don't care if you don't have makeup. And so I just put on my little lab coat, and I could ride my bike there. I could be sweaty. I could have...
So you're how old now? You're living
I'm
in the
63.
Bay. 63. No, I mean, but when you moved to the Bay.
Oh, 23. It was 1978, and I was born in 55, so I was 23 or going to turn 23. right when Harvey Milk was killed and Jim Jones killed 900 people in Guyana. Mm-hmm. Both of those things were very San Francisco-ish. And I think somebody shot someone in over a parking spot. And I just went, what am I getting into? This is freaky. And looking back, I was probably 11 when the Manson murders happened mm-hmm. in Los Angeles. And being able to read and hear, and of course with a dad who's a psychoanalyst, there's probably a fair amount of chewing all about that. I don't remember it at all. I just remember the sheer random savagery and how you really didn't know if somebody was going to knock on your door and just, like, come in swinging a machete. But that didn't sit high in, you know, at the top of my head. It was deep down inside, and I was riding my bike everywhere because my parents wouldn't let me ride a car.
And where had you settled? Where was the first place that you lived in when you moved here to the Bay?
Oh, in the Coal Valley,
in San
Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Sleeping in under a friend's staircase until she finally said, you got to get a rental.
You were entirely on your own financially?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you're 23, you're on your own.
Right. And I was not going to I got the kind of job that didn't pay very well, and I could live in a Victorian with five other people for $50 a month and fill up my days with all the fun activities ranging from seeing movies at the Strand on Market Street for 5 hours at a time, and they were all like European art films for mm-hmm. some reason, and I never understood why I heard snoring or why it smelled like pee or, you know, that there might be guys making out or whatever. I was there for the movies, but it was a $2, you know, for as long as you wanted to stay in there. And other people using for being out of the rain or out of the cold. And I totally did not grasp that. So I was something of a dimwit. But I was a nanny. So I made sure to have jobs that gave me a place to live in exchange for my labor mm-hmm. as a tender of children. So those would usually last about a year, sometimes two, and keep me from having to pay rent. And one of the secretary at the animal hospital, Blue Cross Animal Hospital, she didn't use the bicycle that somebody gave her when she was in her 20s. She's a big fat lady. So she sold me her Raleigh Sprite for $50, and that was probably the mid-60s model, very solid Sheffield steel, or Nottingham, sorry. Anyway, great bike with a wicker basket, just like the kind that Miss Gulch used in the Wizard of Oz. So I had this, you know, little old lady.
Da, 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 da,
right.
da, 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 and she comes
right.
along.
Da, 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 da.
Oh, yeah, that's it. Da, 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 da,
with her little dog, So not paying for a car because I didn't have one. And that I can also sort of hit the rewind. At Taft High School in Woodland Hills, I lived in Tarzana and I rode my bike to school when almost everybody carpooled. I was only 3 miles away from the high school, so I rode my bike. And it was a drag because everybody else got to arrive in a car and stuff. But, of course, it got me strong and more self-sufficient. My mom just refused to drive the kids anywhere. She didn't buy into the chauffeur role because she learned to drive in her 30s. She was terrified of driving. And I inherited the fear of driving and the loathing of cars. And I was going to say, one of my teachers pointed out on the board, he drew a Venn diagram and said, this is your life, and you're going to spend this much of your life earning to pay for a car. That was about a third. And you're going to spend this part of your life earning to pay for shelter and your rent. And I raised my hand and said, Mr. Radetzky, I'm going to want to sleep the other third. When am I going to play Scrabble, go hiking, do nothing, if it's all to pay for our house and transpo, you know? Which, again, I did not carry that in my cerebral cortex. It lived further back in the brain and just sat there on a very low flame, reminding me that Jackie Phelan is not going to support a car company, and she's not going to support, you know, a landlord. I'm going to figure out a workaround because, oh, and then don't have kids. That's another big thing. Like, then I don't have to, there's, he didn't even think of the Venn diagram, but if you have kids, you know, that's probably that much.
Yeah,
anyway,
right.
So I just,
make
you know,
that bigger.
It's a, it
yes.
looks a little bit like a Mercedes symbol or.
Well, I can see the pie slice for the time where you just relax and let the pores open is minuscule compared to.
For your average American, it is really a rat race, and I didn't want to be part of that. And so I've gotten to own my entire prime and decide what to do. And I've misspent it for sure. I mean, I feel like racing was probably misspent. And I have a knack for writing, and I'm not really doing that. But as I wrote around
writing, WR.
I
yes,
should say scribbling versus scribbling and pedaling. Mm-hmm. That way they don't sound the same. Anyway,
yes.
On a 50-pound or a 60-pound bike, you're riding all over San Francisco because I went back. Like, I finished college in Vermont, but then I had went for seconds at City College because it was free, basically free. And I kept trying to, like, get a better grade in chemistry, so I would take chemistry again and physics again and thinking about going, you know, like applying to medical school and having the passing the MedCat, which is a sort of a test for your
to get into med school.
Well, yeah, it's a hurdle you have to get over, and I never even got close to taking the MedCat, but I sure wasted a lot of time chasing chemistry and physics down, and not, you know, just I had no idea that maybe my brain isn't organized for. I mean, some people, like my younger brother Gregory, just loves geometry, and I mean, he obviously got into and out of medical school, so. Different aptitudes, but
your aptitude in whether you could, you know, were really thinking about it, but it's just not so easy to ride a bike all over San Francisco.
Well, it's
there are a
labor,
lot of hills.
It's labor, and also survival tactics.
Traffic,
one of my survival tactics was to wear after my first really bad crash was riding with my groceries in one hand on my Peugeot PX10 10 speed. I think that the right hand operates the back brake, and I was on Irving Street in a car. The light was green, and she didn't go. And I was trying to avoid railroad tracks, or tram tracks, and then this car like go, and she didn't because she was stalled. And so I bumped into her car and fell over and tossed my groceries, and I was fine, but the bike was not able to roll. So she drove me home, and I went and got a helmet. Mm-hmm. A couple days later, a big, ugly mixing bowl called a Bell Biker. Mm-hmm. It's a big white thing with two red stripes that makes a V.
Yes.
And it's made of Lexan. And you can really, you know, like you can dry lettuce, you swing it. you can use it for many things. Headrest, if you're lying down and tired, just prop your head up. So that had a toy duck affixed to the top in order to get traffic not only to notice but to point and laugh. So that little duck sailed through traffic above all the hoods of the cars. Because, you know, when you're on a bike, you're kind of – some depends on the car, of course, SUVs and trucks, you're under them. But you're sort of eye level with all these motorists sitting around using fossil fuels to get them everywhere. And I'd rather be the clown that makes them grin rather than the bozo that ignored the red light or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of known for that duck on the helmet.
I was, yeah.
I
raced with it, too. I raced with a hard shell helmet instead of a leather hairnet because I felt like I didn't have a $5 head, so I'm not going to wear a $5 helmet. I'm going to I'm going to protect my precious asset, which is buffed in college. I was really quite the snob about my education because as I moved into bike racing, I came at it from being more an Earth Justice type, using a bicycle and not having, you know, I wasn't ready to have a kid because I hadn't found my mate or anything, but I definitely wanted to pollute less, have less of an impact, and also get great legs. You know, like on a bike, you are doing about six things, mental health, physical health, cardio, not so great for, I mean, the lungs are taking in all the pollutants. You're sucking in vast amounts of diesel and bus fumes and car stuff. It's maybe not so great, but it's probably offset by all the positive things that come with riding a bike. And it does free up a lot of time because you're not waiting for a bus and then late for wherever you're going. On a bike, you know exactly how long it takes you to get places because you can sort of ignore the traffic. That if there's 400 cars not able to move, you just go alongside them, and you can even honor the stop signs and stop lights if you want. You're still able to know how long it takes to get from where I lived when I was going to City College. I lived in about 10 places, but for the longest time I lived in Cow Hollow, which is right along the bay, and City College is a whole city away.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go up through Presidio and then along Parker and then through the park, then up 8th to avoid the traffic on 7th, and then wiggle through some really beautiful neighborhoods, cross over, I forget what the name of that street is, and end up in St. Francis Wood, which put me right by City College, and on a street with my name on it. They've changed it because Phelan was he's a senator who drafted the Anti-Chinese Immigration Act, and so they've given, I don't know what, maybe it's Tubman Street now. I have no idea what it is, but for a while the address of City College was 50 Phelan, mm-hmm. and I think they said Phelan, so I thought, well, okay, you can say Phelan. I still say Phelan.
Before we move on to the mountain biking aspect of your life, I wanted to ask you, what was your degree? And you went to college, you finished school,
yeah.
Undergrad.
Yeah, I finished in record time. Once I stopped being a pre-med, I took French literature. 19th century French lit was my major. Mm-hmm. And I took it because I switched from, you know, pre-med where you don't get any electives to that because in order to live in a beautiful chateau that somebody had taken apart and reassembled at Middlebury, you had to be a French major.
So you were in Middlebury?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they had this chateau on campus and, you know, I would do anything to live in that building. So French major, no problem. I'm really good at French. And so then I took another language too, German, so I could sort of justify a language major. And it was great. And I made a whole bunch of friends in a neighboring dorm that were all freshmen. So they were a little younger than me. And, you know, in those first years at college, it's because I'm so immature. You know, like I did have my friends from when I was a freshman, but the proximity of all these other freshmen made them the people I pretty much stayed in touch with for most of my life. With the exception of my best friend, Margie Campion. Her last name was Norton, but she took me to Thanksgiving when, because my parents wouldn't fly me home for
did
holidays.
They pay for your education?
They did.
That's great.
Yeah,
Middlebury
is
such a good school.
Right. I got 2 years of their pay. Mm-hmm. And then I cobbled together some credits from AP classes so I could finish and graduate, but they stopped paying as soon as I stopped being a pre-med. And it was not they, it was Dad. Mom had a different take on it, but she really didn't make much of an income herself.
So you graduated what year?
77.
Okay. So let's move forward now back to San Francisco. And when was it that you ended up coming to Marin County, or at least starting to ride with the guys? Tell me your story about how you met up with...
Sure.
The whole biking gang that would soon become...
Peddling around San Francisco, a guy sort of confronted me, 20 years older than me. His name is Daryl Skrabach, Skrabak. And he's probably about 80 now, because I'm 63. And he's just a total diehard biker commuter. And he thought I should consider racing. But also, would I kindly come with him to the San Francisco Bike Coalition meetings? He was one of the founders of the SF Bike Coalition, who were like a little political arm attempting to get funding for things like bike paths and grab it from Muni, which always got all the millions for whatever Muni wanted to do. So I'd go to those meetings, and the first race that he took me to was January 1st, 1981. It was called the San Bruno Hill Climb, and you began, everybody mustered at the docks of Lake Merced and then kind of paraded to wherever the base of the hill is at San Bruno. And I don't remember exactly how to get there, Brisbane maybe. So it was like a 5-mile warm-up. And this is like January 1st.
And you're on a road bike now.
On a road bike.
Mm-hmm.
They had announced that the Olympics were going to permit women to race bicycles. And I immediately went, oh, I should be in the Olympics because I'm so great at biking. Now that they've lifted the ban on women being on two wheels and that. And they also lifted the ban on women, you know, doing marathons. So they introduced the marathon and the bike race at LA 84. So 81, I'm like, sign up, become, a, you know, like an official bicycle racer, got my little license. And this Daryl had told me in November, you need to ride down to L, you know, like if you're going to go home for Christmas, you should really ride your bike. So I did. Took about 5 or 6 days.
So you rode from San Francisco to
Los Angeles, to, mm-hmm. to Sherman Oaks. And I don't know how this plays into the document, but in 1980, January 1980, my mom shot my dad in the head, but didn't kill him. And then nursed him back to health. And at the end of that year, John Lennon was murdered. And that was when I was riding my bike to L.A. And those things also sat way closer to the front of my head than, say, worrying about Charles Manson or, mm-hmm. or murderous motorists that are mad at bikers because they can make it through traffic. So this, to me, was like, you know, evidence that maybe adulthood is toxic. Don't grow up. Certainly don't have children. Never get married. I forget what other bizarre takeaways I had from that. But the race, which I won, you know, like they looked at the tally. It was like a, you know, mass start, 3 miles uphill, almost all uphill. And my bicycle friends at the time, and I had 3 or 4 guys that were very big. I'll get to my dating issues. These guys that happened all except Daryl B., in relationships, but they were huge fans and they loved riding with me because I could keep up with them and stuff. And in this race, I bested them too. I didn't actually see them. The gun goes off and I just charge for the top. I don't remember what place I got. I might have gotten 27th out of 70, but first woman. And I just, like, I had to call one of my dad's colleagues, Ernie Masler, who at the time was actually housing my youngest brother, Gregory, because Gregory was 15 when Mom shot Dad, and Gregory had to clean the bedroom wall, mop up the brains, and it's maybe not an irony that he's a neuroradiologist. But anyway, my dad somehow, he recovered enough to be a therapist for one patient who was quite perspicacious and found out how to reach Dr. Phelan at home. And asked for to continue her therapy. She was a 50-year-old professor at Cal Northridge named Catherine. I don't remember her maiden name, but she became Catherine Phelan.
So she oh, did, that became his second wife?
Yes. And at that point, when he began seeing her, in quotes, my mom, that's when my mom ended her life in 1983. And just, like, take him, he's yours.
And he's, I'm out of here.
Yeah. She had actually threatened suicide most of our lives. We never knew when she was going to do it. Mm-hmm.
She suffered from depression?
Yeah. And depression, possibly bipolar, impulsive, very, very smart. Because she had an indifferent mom. She didn't really know how to mother, but she certainly did try a lot of the time. But she also was vicious and pitted us against each other, so it was a fucking mess. The Phelan family was a disaster. Mm-hmm. And she checked herself out, but not before she met Charlie. So I rode down in 1980. I rode down to L.A. I was in great shape for that race, New Year's. Partied hard until 4 in the morning and slept for 2 hours and then went and did that race, won it, called Masler and said, hey, I'm good at something. I'm going to do it some more. And he was so proud of me. And he also, not only was he looking, you know, taking in Gregory to live with his family for, like, I don't know, half a year or something. He was a biker. I would run into him when I was living in San Francisco, the Valley as a teenager, high school student, riding my bike everywhere, like not only to school, but out around Topanga, down to the beach, up along Mulholland. Well, there were certainly not a lot of girls riding mm-hmm. at all. I never saw people, but I did see Dr. Masler, and I just, like, he rides a bike. Oh, how cool. And a couple of guys named the Grossmans, Steve and, Ken Grossman, brothers from Taft. They created Sierra Nevada Brew.
Brewery. Oh.
They were they made their own beer.
And they were riders as well?
They were big riders, big racers. And I ran into them once or twice. And I remember one of them gently aiding me up the hill with a little, you know, touch on the small of my back. Just, I'm like, oh, that's nice. And it's a classic.
Not exactly catching the draft, but.
No. He was just pushing. He's riding alongside and giving me a little shove. And it was sweet and, you know, not harassment. It was welcome. And because I honestly, you know, I hadn't had a boyfriend. I didn't have a boyfriend until I was in college. So anyway, I'm riding around the the Los Angeles area on a bike. And actually, two of my high school chums were big bikers. So we would go ride and sometimes even find ourselves on dirt on our road bikes.
So you're basically, one way or another, finding yourself in the world of biking all the time.
Right.
It was a lifestyle for
you. I never would call it a lifestyle. It was plan B because I wasn't getting chauffeured by mom. Mm-hmm. And as with many things that you initially start off hating, you fall in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's Stockholm Syndrome or what, but the bicycle wooed and won me for sure. And I used to make cartoons of me in bed with my bike. And actually, when I went to college, my parents held on to my bike and kept it hostage, and I had to go and steal it. That 1980 trip, I don't remember how I got home. I did not pedal back from visiting that Christmas. It was the first Christmas with Dad being brain injured and Mom taking care of him. The bullet remained in his head because I couldn't extract it without hurting him. And he lost his sense of direction and became kind of invalid. He was legally blind, but an avid reader, so he read voraciously. Even though he was legally blind, he could somehow read. But he had shitty sight, so he qualified for a dog, and that's what he got that with Catherine when he moved in with his second wife, who was married to him years longer than Mom and Dad had been married.
It's an interesting kind of foreshadowing where when I hear you describing this about your dad's brain injury, and that will come forward.
Oh yeah,
how it plays. I mean, there's some reflection of that in your life.
Theme. Yeah,
let's focus now.
But dating, let me just give three sentences to the dating, because I lived in the city and I would go on dates, and my idea of a good time was riding from the city to around Tiburon or home, and I never got a second date with these guys. They never wanted to.
Because you outrode them?
Yeah, they were wasted, and sometimes we'd have to bail
because
and take the ferry.
Because it was a wild
ferry.
Party time. People listening to this interview, when you're talking about the late 70s and early 80s,
right.
There was a lot of drugs and partying going
on. That hasn't actually changed that I know of. It's just that it was safer. There wasn't such thing as AIDS. And Reagan had gotten elected, and I guess that was like a stampede towards, you know, Wall Street and the diminution of our social safety net, all kinds of other huge overlays that I was totally unaware of. But my classmates at Middlebury's, you know, even the ones that were artists, you know, like they were, recruited by Wall Street to become, you know, that sort of money toy, you know, paper purse pusher that can get really rich. And so that's what a few, because kids at Middlebury were from very wealthy families.
Not you.
Well, hey, Dad didn't really share his whatever fortune he earned as a psychoanalyst. So we grew up, you know, believing we're middle class, and certainly no extravagances. Dad didn't, like, take us on trips to Cozumel. Mom and Dad went, you know, here and there. They do a little
that
travel.
That was common of that time, too, to leave the kids at home and the parents go by themselves. I've interviewed many people who describe that.
Right.
About your dating, because I want to move on to the actual mountain biking and your racing.
Otherwise, this is going to take
because we have just so much time. Yes.
Well, I heard there was a faster breed. Daryl told me, like, we're going to Marin for a ride called the Appetite Seminar on Thanksgiving in 1980.
The Appetite Seminar.
Yeah, the Appetite Seminar was, I rode my old green bike, which I called Vic, for Victoria. So this is like 8 months after Mom shot Dad and before John Lennon was killed. So Thanksgiving, Marin County, we ride our bikes from where I lived, which was Genesee Street, which is near City College, across the bridge and into Fairfax on, you know, the old lady special. And everybody's all mustering and throwing their bikes in a truck. And I'm like, why are you putting your bikes in a truck? Oh, there's a 2 mile hill. So me and Daryl rode up the hill, did the ride, pedaled home to San Francisco. And that was like my opening gambit. Daryl said, you got to go meet that guy, shake hands with him. You know.
And who's that guy?
Eric Kosky. You know, and then he'd say, go over, that's Charles Kelly, go say hi to him. So I'd say, hi, I'm Jackie Phelan. And these guys were like, they wouldn't stick their hands out. They didn't know why I was introducing myself, but I was.
Who else was there?
Gary Fisher. So he had said, go meet that guy. And basically, Daryl, it was sort of like a coming out, you know. He wanted them to meet us. And we were the only people that were not from Marin. We were definitely outliers. He was on Daryl was riding a 10-speed with very narrow tires called a Jack Taylor.
On the Appetite
right. Seminite.
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
And I was on my girl's Raleigh with pretty narrow tires. They're called 1 3/8.
And how many gears?
5.
So
Daryl had 10.
The Appetite Seminar is a famous race.
Yeah, well, it's not a race. It's a ride.
Okay, so my husband's ridden it several times.
Yeah, you just show up in Fairfax at around 8 or 9.
And Thanksgiving.
It's like Thanksgiving.
But it's not easy.
It's a hard ride. And these guys
I'm thinking of you're in a 5-speed.
Right. I was on this vastly inferior machine, and I completed the ride. Daryl, I'm afraid I dropped Daryl, and I rode home alone. He was still, you know, he's 20 years older than I am. On a skinny tile bike, so he had to probably walk some of the descents. And so that also shows what a thoughtful person I am. I leave the guy that brought me. Had to, like, beg food from a restaurant. People, you know, like, in the window of a restaurant. I was like, are you done with that?
you mean you are watching people eat, and if they're finished after the race, you're saying,
It's not a race. It's a fun ride. And everybody goes home to eat.
Oh, I see.
I just hadn't eaten, and I'd ridden roughly 50 miles, half of them dirt. And I, you know, I'm dumb, and I probably have the bonk. So luckily, these people, yeah, sure have that. So I had some, like, 3 rolls and some butter, and then got home to my then-boyfriend's, Mark's, parents' house and demolished their turkey and probably connected with Daryl and found out that he finally arrived alive or something. But that was like my intro to the Marin Men. What I did not remember was that this nice guy noticed my toe clip was missing a bolt and repaired it for me. And it turns out it was Charlie Cunningham. And he told me that after we met. He goes, don't you remember? Your toe clip was totally loose. And because he always carried tools to fix the neck.
Did he have his mountain bike business then with Steve Potts?
It wasn't a business. No, he had built maybe 3 bicycles by then. 3 or 4, and he didn't really know Steve Potts then. He didn't hang with any of the fat tire guys who were all on Schwinn's and Bombers, and they were clique, and Charlie's got social anxiety, and so he doesn't cotton to cliques. He's totally his own guy, and he did not see the sense in riding a big old sled. He rode his mom's 10-speed all over Mount Tam and devised his own idea of what kind of angles to use, and finally when wheels stopped having steel rims and started having aluminum, 26-inch aluminum rims came in probably 1978, and he went, I'm building a bike to fit that. He was going to buy a Klein once, but then he decided I could just, because Klein made aluminum road bikes at the time, and he goes, I can probably weld just as well as that, and I'll make my own, and so I'll spend the money I was going to buy the Klein with and pay for the kind of equipment you need, gas tanks and welders and welding hood and all that stuff. So he ended up making these bikes that were highly experimental. Anytime he didn't like the angles, he'd just break it and, you know, cut it and reshape it. So they were ugly, ugly, strange-looking things. But they definitely did very, very well. And he also had drop bars, so his bikes didn't look – they didn't conform at all. And anyway,
But he fixed your toe clip.
He fixed my toe clip and kind of later saw me packing bicycles – the summer of 81, which is the 5-month period I was with Gary Fisher from May to September.
Oh, you were
September.
In a relationship with Gary Fisher?
Yeah. I met him when I was riding around Tiburon by myself, and he was hanging out at the health food store that they used to have, and goes, oh, hey, I remember you from, you were on a different bike, but you did the ride on Thanksgiving last year. And I go, yeah, that's me. And so we rode together to the Blithedale intersection because I had to peel off and go back to the city. He gave me his phone number. And I couldn't believe the writing. It looked like a third grader. And I was like, wow, what's this? He's probably dyslexic. I don't know. Anyway, we became an item very quickly.
His parents grew up in Tiburon, correct?
No, he actually grew up in Burlingame.
Burlingame. But his parents live there now,
His stepdad and his mom currently live in, and will finish off in Belvedere, I think.
He was already then a racer.
Yes, he was. He was a road and also a partner in mountain bikes, partner with Charlie Kelly and Tom Ritchie. They hadn't broken up yet. So he was doing two things. And he got very excited about road racing again because his brand new girlfriend, was this monster. And
that's you.
Our first date was a race called the Cats Hill, which I won. And the promoter was talking on the microphone, I guess, or the announcer was saying, you know, you're going to see a bunch of women wearing green, and that's going to be who your winner is. That's from the Specialized bicycle team, you know, for Berkeley Bike Club, sponsored by Specialized. I was wearing a wool orange and white thing that I'd won probably at the hill climb, San Bernardino Hill Climb, and I decorated the middle part because it was like half orange and half white, vertical, with lace. I trimmed it with lace. And, of course, I had the helmet and I had the duck.
With the duck, right.
And
So you rode with Gary with the duck helmet on?
Well, he wasn't real crazy about that, actually. But so I probably didn't wear the duck at Cats Hill, which was it's probably gone on for 50 years. It's an annual springtime tradition in Los Gatos. And it has this famous hill, and I was so worried because there was this famous hill, but it's the very same as the little one that leads up to the Presidio on Arguello. It's just this little tiny hump that you just like, and you're up it, but times 20. Sorry, I hit the mic. 20 laps because the women did 20 laps. And I think we even raced, maybe we raced with the older guys called the veterans. But anyway, so I win on a bike whose headset was totally loose. It was, you know, a mess. Gary gets third in his race and gets this incredible prize, set of $300 wheels. I of course, won a pair of gloves and some grease or something.
Oh, dear. So
there's a huge, huge difference.
Yes.
And it just, like, we fought the whole way home, you know. Like, he goes, it's not fair. You know, you win your first race. And I go, it's not fair. You get third and you get these nice wheels. And he was driving around a BMW sedan with the back seat taken out so he could put bikes in it. He was kind of ratty but aspired for wealth, you know, and at least the outer trappings of wealth, and which he continues to this day to aspire to.
He certainly is a very fancy dresser.
Yeah. Yep, it's all... I would say not a whole lot going on inside, but he has to have a lot going on inside in a way because he's had at least four wives. He might be on number five. He's laid children all over the place. He tried to get me impregnated, you know, and I just more or less left my diaphragm in 100% of the time for 5 months because I did not want to have a child, and he kept wanting to like slip one in. And I'm like, but that's, you know, not going to happen. And that along with him not liking my friends when I went back to East to race the Nationals.
So what, did you find that he introduced you to a lot of the Marin riders, though?
Well, riding with him, he didn't actually introduce me. I went with the men on their rides, and I found out how much they loathed me when we broke up. They began
let's talk a little bit about those rides.
Right. They were hard rides like to Petaluma or Valley Forge.
And who are the men
Occidental.
You're riding with? And you're the only woman?
I am the only woman. And I was riding with people with names like Jerry Heidenreich, Otis Guy, Martin McBurney, Owen Mulholland, of course, Gary Fisher, not Charlie Kelly.
How about Joe Breeze?
Joe did not ride with them. I'm trying to think of a few other names. Jerry Heidenreich. I called him Jerry Heidenwrong. So, Maynard Hershon, who worked at Sunshine Bicycles. And he really Maynard saw himself as like this paragon of European style and virtue. You had to wear nobody wore helmets I wore a helmet, but they didn't wear helmets. If they wore anything, they wore a little bike cap. And they had wool jerseys and wool socks. You know, everything was a uniform. And I was wearing, like, wallaby shoes, which are crepe sole, and a Madras shirt, and, you know, and not getting dropped. Well, Gary lent me clothes so that I could conform a little better.
What do you mean, not getting dropped?
They could not leave me behind.
Oh, so they might try to pedal ahead and would keep up.
I'd stick on, yeah. The only way they could ever drop me, and this happened after Gary and I broke up, was when I was sort of at the front of the group as we were wiggling through Fairfax in the little network of streets, I come upon Gary Summers and Otis Guy waiting at the corner. They always waited on the Wednesday rides. And they go, "Where's everybody?" And I go, "What are you talking about?" And I look over my shoulder. There was no one there. They came from a different street, streamed on by, jumped, you know, Otis and Gary Summers jump on, I jump on. And it's a group of maybe 15 guys all buzzing away. And, one, you know, I could hear somebody say, "You'd think she'd take a hint." And, you know, and I asked Martin McBurney, "What's the deal? What hint?" He goes, "Well, Jackie, it's sort of a guy's ride." And I go, "That never was a problem." The whole summer when I was training to be at the national championship, and he says, "Well, that's because you were riding with Gary. You're his, you know."
Interesting.
I just was shattered. But I went, did I go with them anyhow? No.
So you were riding and they diverted away.
Yeah.
So when you came up to Otis and
on the corner of like Spruce and Azalea or whatever.
They were expecting to see the whole
group, gang, and they weren't there.
They had
then just
off.
Taken a ride.
And so then the Otis and the other guy,
Gary Summer,
caught up with the gang.
Well, they all merged because that's what they did. They just, like, the group came along and subsumed.
Oh, they went
Gary
off and left you going one way, and then
they didn't. I just rode along with them, uh-huh, puzzled and talking to Martin McBurney about what the fuck.
Yeah.
And he goes, "Well, Jackie, you know, some guys don't like having you along, and you're kind of a squirrely rider." And, of course, that's true.
What do you mean by a squirrely rider?
Well, you can imagine. How do squirrels behave?
All of it. You could be unpredictable.
That was like the
worst
insult you could sling at a bike rider or racer. There was one other older guy named Bob Snyder, who was probably Daryl's age, maybe a little younger, and a fine rider. So he could keep up with them, even though he was 40, because these guys were in their late 20s. I was 25. And just, I was strong as a fucking ox.
You look strong now, by the way. People can't see you, but you're so fit looking. And, well, I mean, I didn't see you before, but I can, looking at you now.
I was probably a little leaner then. I'm about 10 pounds over. My
You look quite well formed. A 63-year-old woman, extraordinary. So I can
I'm sort of built like a guy. I got long ways, short legs.
I can only imagine how strong you must have been at that time.
Well, yeah, and I'm probably, you know, between the two, extremes of extreme feminine and extreme masculine. I'm kind of in the middle. I remember when I was in, like, elementary school getting teased about my mustache. And I certainly had hairy legs and hairy arms. And so I probably had like a skosh of testosterone that did not hurt in the power department. So I could ride like a guy. And I certainly didn't have a problem with farting or burping and being gross like a guy, and laughed at anybody that was judgmental. And so anyway, this group of guys wanted me out. I peeled off and had a good cry. Owen Mulholland was late that day because he hadn't put his shoe cleat on correctly. So he and I rode together. I told him about how the guy didn't want me on their ride. And he's like, "Yeah, well, you know, for one thing, they're jealous because you're in your third month of racing and you're winning all the road races. You're winning everything. It's not fair. These guys are never going to see the amount of."
But you're racing with women or racing with men?
I was racing with men. I mean, sorry, women. Winning races against women. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I would train by racing with men before the women's race because I could, just to get stronger, Because if I'm the strongest...
So it was the prize that they, that you feel that they were intimidated by? That you, it's just that you kept one?
No, it was a combination of things. I mean, and of course, if you can keep a gal out, you, what you're doing is less groovy. But if there's a woman doing what you're doing, then what you're doing isn't quite as awesome. Because a chick can do it. And certainly there were guys that were like, I'm quitting if a woman ever beats me.
Oh, really? Let's
talk
about some of the misogynists.
Well, that's the pure, it's 100% misogynist little group of guys. And
was there passive-aggressive swipes your way regularly?
Oh, all the time. All the time.
So let's talk about this from the feminist perspective, because I'm just not getting this kind of information in any of my interviews with anyone else, really.
Okay,
so describe, if you were to take inventory of the various things or swipes or...
Let me tell you an anecdote or two.
Yes.
I could be at Lucky Market, which is now the Good Earth, 100 feet away from Maynard Hirshon, because that's supermarkets right across from Sunshine. And maybe they were probably mustering from the city and all around. And I could see Maynard lean over and say something to the biker standing next to him and, like, pointing at me with his chin, and then the other guy would just, like, laugh. It's not the same as going, ha, 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 and pointing, but I knew that he was saying something derogatory about me. And then, fast forward 20 years, I'm taking a class at College of Marin on screenplay writing. I turned in a screenplay about a standout woman writer who was not favored by the men that she had to ride and train with, because in order to be good enough for the Olympics, you have to ride with fast people in fast conditions with big turns and, you know, dangerous. You have to get better at riding in a crowd. You can't do that riding by yourself, unlike mountain biking. So in 2009, Sandy Hancher, my screenwriting teacher, heard Otis talking at the coffee shop. She was having coffee. Because Otis is calling out the names and greeting everybody that goes by on San Anselmo Avenue. You go, hi, George. There goes Owen.
And so this is the community of bikers that all know.
They've known each other for 20 or 30 years.
Yes. Okay.
2009 is,
if you're on a bike,
25 years after my entree into this world. I'm now permanently installed in Marin County. And I'm riding along on my breezer going to, like, College of Marin or doing something, and I can hear Otis's booming voice greeting all these people and showing off how many people he knows. So he calls out my name, and I don't even look up. I don't even wave. I just, like, you know, I'm not giving you the pleasure of acknowledging, because you're just doing that to use me. And sure enough, Sandy gave me the entire script after I went, you know, she's at class that week. She says, Jackie, you know, that thing you were writing about is still going on. You go by, Otis says, there goes Jackie Phelan. She's crazy. And the guy he's next to, who looked Latino, said, yeah, well, she's married to Charlie Cunningham. And then Otis goes, yeah, well, I do have to admit she does something three times. And I'm guessing Sandy couldn't make it out, but I've beaten Otis in some races.
And Otis is a big, strong guy.
Yes, he is. But he was probably a hardworking fireman and couldn't train quite as much. Or I might have bested him when he was sick. You know, like, that's usually what happens. You're sick. You've been off the bike for 500 years, and that's why that chick beat you. But anyway, he's my number one detractor, but he never shows it. He makes a big deal of saying hi when he has to, because people see him not saying hi to me. All I can do is give him a glare back, because we're not friends. I'd love to make up, but, you know, he and Jerry Heidenreich, they wanted me out of their club. It wasn't even a real club. And so I'd prefer to remain...
Do you have a sense that your sex itself, they were less...
My gender?
Yes, your gender in that...
Well, I'm not conforming to the girls can't keep up thing.
Well, how about the fact that... I mean, I'm the same age as you. I remember the way that women were received. I mean,
they have to be accommodating and pleasant, and actually they need to smile. We are supposed to smile. I mean, people see you on the street, a guy will say, put a smile on your face.
Right. Back then, very common men might even say, you need to lose 5 pounds or gain five
right.
pounds.
The entitlement. Or you'd be great if you had bigger boobs.
Yes, this is very common.
Or they'd talk in mixed company about being a breast man or a leg man or you know, whatever.
Yes.
And my dad, you know, he was a Freudian psychoanalyst, and we grew up in a hyper-sexualized environment where almost every gesture, every wrestling match was interpreted as latent wish for, you know, sex with your sibling or whatever. And I'm just like, oh, God.
Because I think at a time when, for many men, intimacy was with a woman would have been considered a sexual thing exclusively.
Right. Yeah.
Friendship wasn't really...
barely existed.
Yes, barely existed. The idea that women, men and women were in such different worlds, hard for some people to imagine now, but I certainly recall that the idea of men didn't really know how to be friends with women.
Right, and they also didn't know how to be dads. There was the women's sphere and the men's sphere, and the guy came home hoping for dinner, you know, like the family guy. It was very restricting and led to early death for the guys and kids not knowing their dad growing up through the 50s and 60s.
So there were traps for both women and men
yeah,
in that
but
time.
The 60s were the time of all that social ferment, and my mom definitely, you know, like she bitterly complained about the Pope, you know, being anti-contraception, and you know, but he should be paying for all the babies that come from all that. And so I really got a snootful of feminism. And then that was also when I went for my 1 year of junior year abroad, I took feminism as one of my classes, mm-hmm. the history of feminism, especially because in France there had been this student revolution in 1968, and 75 was not that long after 68. And some of the universities were still kind of in tatters from having nearly no janitorial and the students sort of running the show. But it was a real great eye-opener, and also to be away for 1976, away from the, you know, the bicentennial of this great country that is not such a great country.
So, but back to the gender issue,
right.
I mean, male versus male, female, because I really would like to capture this part of your story. At that time, it was kind of on the precipice of change.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easily forgotten the subtleties of chauvinism.
Right, or the insidiousness. It wasn't subtle. It was just, baked in.
It was ubiquitous.
It was ubiquitous, baked in, assumed. Oh, and by the way, in the intro, I forgot to say that I had this alter ego named Alice B. Toe Clips.
Uh-huh.
And because having spent my 6 months in Paris, I knew all about Gertrude Stein and Alice Toklas, the Oakland heiress. There were these two rich ladies that were lovers and lifelong companions and history makers, and they lived in Paris and fed all the starving artists, the Picassos and the Artaud and the, you know, Miro and James Joyce and Hemingway, whoever. Gertrude entertained the guys and Toklas fed the wives. And I liked that nickname, and that allowed me to have like this gnarly self-assured side, as well as the frightened little girl that just wants to be liked. That's Jackie Phelan, the one with no self-esteem at all. So I had these, you know, binary personality, because on the bike I'm Alice B. Toe Clips, and a jester, sort of a court jester for what I think of as entertainment. To me, bike racing was entertainment, not rocket science.
Were there any other women that raced with you back then?
Oh, yeah.
Let's get their names.
Well, when I got to the race, there weren't Marin County women racing.
So you were the only Marin County woman
that
racing?
I know of. The Berkeley women were very strong. Cindy Olivari, Madeline Racy, R-O-E-S-E, Kim Lucas. Lucas really, really hated me. Everybody was like, it takes 5 years to be a bike racer. I'm like, oh, me, I'm in my third month. Ain't I something? And it's like, yeah, you're something scary because you can't ride in a straight line. And you keep asking for room. Well, you have to be able to be knuckle to knuckle with people and calm, cool, and collected and not afraid to crash. And I was not too afraid to crash, but anyway, there were a couple of – Cindy Olivari was nice to me. A gal named Hannah North from San Diego was very nice to me. And Liz Newberry, who went to Stanford. I did race for, like, two or three months before I really got into the United States Cycling Federation, USCF, I raced collegiate because I was going, I had a, you know, a student card from City College. I was called the Gang of One because I just made up the fact that I'm, you know, like on a team, and I decorated a T-shirt. And Stanford drove me to all the races. There were races in Davis and Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo. And since there was room in the team van at Stanford, Liz Newberry very graciously let me come along with her and her team. Collegiates were started by Tim Nicholson at Stanford in the mid-70s, probably. So it was a relatively fresh thing to have, like, intramural bike racing as well as, like, track and field, tennis, and all the other, you know, fencing and stuff.
Right.
And Newberry is just an incredible woman. She's now Liz Chapman, and she was gracious to me then, and we're in touch. We've gone on rides. We're pen pals. She lives down in the South Bay. She married her Stanford classmate, Harlan Chapman, and he's a great guy, too. So anyway, she really is like a shining star, and Olivari was just nice because she was hard to beat and could be magnanimous. I don't know if her being a lesbian helped, because I think Kim Lucas might have been a lesbian and she hated me. But a lot of the women were just like, oh, God, this chick, she's just too much. And, you know, stay away from her. Stay off
too much. Interesting choice of words. Now, I have heard a story, and I want to ask you if it's true or not, that when you go across the final line there.
Oh, that happened one time.
One time?
When I was mountain bike racing.
So let's tell that story.
Sure. So when Gary and I were together only 5 months, but I did one mountain bike race called Whiskey Town in 1981. And then after we broke up and I began seeing Charlie Cunningham, I rode Charlie's bike, was finishing real early in these mass start races of 300 to 600 people. And one day, like a week after having put a women's mountain bike camp together with my friend Casey Patterson, I told the gals at that camp, if I don't get my jersey from SunTour, which was one of the sponsors of the team I was on, which was SunTour WTB, if they don't deliver the jersey, I'm going to wear a swimsuit with Charlie's last name Cunningham painted in Carolingian minuscule script, big 3-inch letters, by a friend of mine who's an artist, Ross Schaefer's wife, Colleen Hillis, decorated my back. And so I was wearing a competition swimsuit that had showed all my back, polka dot, Lycra bike shorts. And by this time, this is like 1984, I've been with Charlie for at least two years. I've won all the mountain bike races. And there's a handful of, one in particular, but a couple, three women that really, you know, took racing kind of seriously. And one of them was Cindy Whitehead. And she had, apparently, according to some journalist, my picture on her mirror. She really wanted to beat me, but it took 6 years before she beat me. But anyway, that day, because of the combination up in, this was up in Santa Rosa, the race was called the Rockhopper, and it was a benefit for the American Lung Association. The promoter, Lynn Wozniacki, was a woman, and it was a phenomenal fundraiser for the Lung Association. And of course, we're all gasping for air when we get back across the line. The pack starts off. We're all wearing scarves because it's so dusty. And the pro men had to do an extra 4 miles or something. So somehow when I'm coming back, I'm all by myself. And I stop and roll the one-piece bathing suit down and finish the last 5 miles without a shirt on. That's different than hoisting my shirt at the finish line.
So I had heard you hoisted your shirt off.
Well, they're wrong.
You had the writing on your back.
I had my writing. That was my sponsor's name. I had my number. I made sure to have my number written on my.
Had you planned to roll your bathing suit down?
Of course. And I wanted to have, like, you know, I for sure wanted to have Cunningham. And I could tell from the tracks, when the sun is just right, you can tell, like, how many people have passed, even though there's 600 people racing. Coming the other direction, and I see there's one set of tracks, so I'm going to be the second person across the line. Great. So I cross the line like this.
Your hands up.
My hands are in a big, fat victory, and I hear from
a kid named Daryl Price years later. You corrupted me. I was 13. I heard somebody else say, some guy said, oh, now I know I'm in California. Somebody else said, it's a guy, it's a girl. No, it's a guy. No, it's a girl. They couldn't tell because when I'm spread eagle, I'm pretty flat. And I was very, very fit. And a lot of, you know, dancers and a lot of athletic women don't have massive jugs. Cindy Whitehead had phenomenal pillowy bosoms. And she was very favored for that. And it was very obvious. And it was, you know, because there was slavering admiration that grossed me out. She, of course, sucked it up. And I don't blame her. You know, like us women will just, you know, do almost anything to be popular. And or some of us will. Not so the lesbians, though.
But
they don't give
a
shit.
When you're going across...
I'm crossing spread eagle,
I'm
no
looking
shirt.
At you. You look very feminine. I mean, you look... Anyway, you're topless, and you are a woman.
Right. But I got the helmet on. We all look the same with a helmet. I had a black... by then, the VON Pro came along. It was a little bit more tidy-looking helmet. Charlie Cunningham was the first person across the line.
So your husband-to-be...
My husband-to-be, my boyfriend.
Would be the first, and then comes...
Then me, and then...
And are men... Do men cross the line without tops on?
Oh, there were plenty of guys with no shirt. Okay. Plenty of guys. And there were people that wanted me, like Tom, I'm trying to remember what his last name is, Tom Hillard from Specialized. I don't know if he worked for Specialized then, but anyway, he thought I should be banned from racing.
So, yeah, this is the fallout. What's the fallout?
Well, the fallout was photos in the paper of me kind of walking away. It didn't really show me too much, but, you know, she loses her shirt at the races. And then some negative fallout about, like, how dare you? I mean, what would you think if a guy whipped his dick out at the finish line? And I go, well, there's actually a slight difference between the sexual organs and breasts. So to me, that's not the same at all. It's not. It shouldn't be an affront to show my front. And luckily, the promoter was this woman who thought it was hilarious. And, you know, I mean, I don't think there were too many people shielding their children's eyes. And I rolled my shirt back up after I crossed the line.
The bathing suit.
I meant my TYR brand swimsuit, one-piece swimsuit. I rolled my swimsuit back up so I could be decent. And although, you know, you got to admit, racing one-pieces are extremely our swim coaches at City College pick the most nauseating, like, you know, pure sex swimsuits that they could. They were super high cut, and they complained about, the coaches complained that I was, I should shave my pubic hair. And I go, like, dude, you picked that suit. I'm not shaving. You just, like, look the other way, okay? Get used to there's a couple of curly pubes sticking out. It's not, you know, it's your problem, not my problem. And so I've always been kind of
in your
had
face.
A fuck you yeah. attitude about people wanting to have their women shaven clean and, you know, like look like a little pre-pubescent girl or whatever. And I did get some fallout. Luckily, the fallout didn't, like, take away my first place or anything. It just it cemented into a legend that I lifted my shirt at the finish line, which is not quite true. So it's really nice to waste 2.5 minutes. That, yeah, I had a swimsuit on. I rolled it down. And then 10 or 15 years later, I'm in Hungary reading a magazine that's Hungarian. It's an interview with Tom Ritchie. And I go, why is my name in the Tom Ritchie interview? And so the Hungarian guy that flew me out to teach Hungarian boys mountain bike skills and manners, he goes, well, it says here, what was the wildest thing you've ever seen mountain biking? And Tom's answer was, Jackie Phelan finishing topless at the Rockhopper 1984. So that was Tom Ritchie's wildest thing he's ever seen. And it might help.
Boy, and he was in the Bay Area?
Well, he lives. He's a conservative Christian. He's an evangelical Christian that has beliefs about women and their role. Still does.
Do you still face this kind of this kind of percolating... It's because the people you're with are the men you're with, the world you're in, they're still the older men. They're a product of their bringing
time.
Up, of their time and their place and the socialization of the time. Do you find that the men that were so shocked back then have softened in their view of what women can and cannot do with time or how they should behave? Or is it something you faced all of your life?
It's a damn good question that I don't really know the answer to, although I was hanging with one of my racing friends who was on a different team. He's a guy. He was up for this weekend because there was a fundraiser at the bike museum. His name is Jim Harlow, and he raced for the Ross team. And Cindy Whitehead was on the Ross team. She asked her teammates to please block me so that she could win. But they'd have to, in order to do that, Cindy would have to be ahead of them, and they'd be behind her somehow, and then they'd slow down or whatever to keep me from winning. But that, you know, like Harlow said, you know, I had asked him, is it true Cindy wanted you to fall over in front of me? He goes, no, she wanted us to block for you, but she was never in front of us, so, you know, she could never do it, but she sure wanted us to block. And that's perfectly legit in road racing, by the way. Big teams, you try to get your guy or gal up in front, and then the rest of the team tries to impede others from making progress to catch that person. So it's a type of classic road tactic. And she was a road racer as well as a mountain bike racer. This past weekend, Harlow was talking about, you know, being beaten by a girl. Like, I've never been beaten by a girl. I never want to be beaten. And when he said beaten by a girl, I said, Jim, don't forget who you're talking to. And then he went on, like, a minute or two later, he was saying something like, yeah, I'm still, you know, never been beaten by a girl. And I go, that's your second chance. And I was with a younger couple of guys that are in their 30s, and they noticed, but he didn't notice. And it was funny, you know. He is a product of his time, and he's a dear, dear person, and I don't care.
What if you were to take your shirt off in a race now? What do you think would happen?
Oh, I've actually done it. I did it at the Single Speed World the Bike Messenger World Championship. I'd raced an entire lap naked in San Francisco in 1996. 96 was when the Messenger Championships were. They're here and there around the world. Mm-hmm. And
the Bike Messenger Championships.
Mm-hmm. And so all you do is pay your $75 and you get to be in. And
so you bicycled naked?
Yeah, there were lots of there were 3 days of festivities, different kinds of races. And
were you
one
alone
of them,
or were there others?
No, I was the only person racing naked. I only did one lap, but I because they were taking. It was a race where they'd take the last person and take him out of the race, and it was like it's called Devil Take the Hindmost. And unfortunately,
kind of like a relay thingy.
No, it wasn't a relay.
Oh, they just shed off as you're the last.
Yeah,
they'd
like you're the last. You're done. You're the last. You're done. Mm-hmm. And all the lasts were women. And I was like, they should have figured out a way to not cull only the women, because then there won't be any, you know, there was a very, very strong woman named Kraft. I don't remember her first name, but in German that means power. And she did very well. She was sort of like
Back to the naked riding.
But so I just did one lap naked.
You to do so?
Oh, just because I could. Yeah, I'm in San Francisco. And it was certainly embraced, which was great. And then I went back and put all my clothes on, but I didn't get a rest. I got to ride my bike naked, and somebody took a picture. And believe me, when you're crouched over a race bike, everything interesting is covered up. I also had a rather large messenger bag on my back, so I'm sure my gluteal fissure showed. And we were going up and down like Vallejo, really steep streets
yes.
in the downtown area. So it was just to me, it was hilarious, but I think there is like a strong exhibitionist part of me that's like, here I am, look at me, deal with it. And now that I'm 62 or 3, I feel like I've actually gotten feedback because I've done the appetite ride mm-hmm. now and then with no shirt and gotten friends would send me comments from Facebook or something that like, my eyes bled after that, or I felt my eyes melting, or, you know, like, what an awful sight to see a pair of old lady boobs. That was what they were saying. And I just went, wow, well, I'm still bringing it.
Now, we unfortunately can't stay here for too much longer. I really would like to
talk about wombats. Could it be two parts?
Yes. You, the interview?
Or I could just talk faster.
No, don't talk faster. We're going to we'll
be fine.
Yeah, we'll catch up here a little. We'll bring in some other things because there's a few things I'd like to ask you. One will be about wombats. Also, your long time with Charlie Cunningham, yeah. Recent changes in your relationship, and right. and your affiliation with your friends that are mountain bikers now, and the bike museum. I'd like to capture, if we can, those topics. So,
all right, thanks for helping steer.
Yeah, let's steer in that direction. Let's pedal in that direction. That's a better metaphor. So which would you like to address first?
I guess wombats, because to me, having this domain be male-defined while I'm in it, trying to create a welcoming space for women was a piece of cake, literally. Fred Heitman's Bread and Chocolate Bakery provided free pastries on Sunday rides when I led wombat rides. And they were almost every week in the mid-'80s. I hadn't come up with the name Wombats quite yet.
And that's an acronym for
three Women's place. Possessive Mountain Bike and Tea Society. And I'm particular about that "and" being an ampersand because it looks so nice and old-fashioned. And I wanted the club to resemble the period when women took to bikes big time in the 1880s during the huge bicycle craze when sheet music by the thousands, bike sales, the burgeoning and growing mass market saw the chance to double their profits if they could just allay Victorian fears about women being outside of their sphere and away from the control of their husband or chaperone or parent. So how they did that was take out ads in the magazines with names like Godey's Ladies' Book, and I don't know what the other names of the other books are, but they were big magazines.
They were cover names, really, then, right, for women to get together, or?
Cover names?
Say the names again of the
groups. Oh, Godey's Ladies' Book was like Red Book or O Magazine.
Oh, okay.
It was a very, and magazines exploded when lithography and type change made it possible to have cheap publications, mm-hmm. and they weren't subscription-based. They were advertising-based, and that was such a huge change. So then the magazines would cater to the advertiser, and the advertiser wanted to sell twice as many bikes, but they had to get over, like, no daughter of mine is going to be found straddling something, you know, and my dad actually used that term, too. He said, no daughter of mine is going to be an athlete, a trained seal, is how he put it. You know, when I asked him for some more gymnastics lessons in junior high, he's like, no daughter of mine is going to be a trained seal. Surprise, Dad, you know. Be careful what you forbid. Anyway, those days, the women caught into the machine. They got cheaper. And girls were able to buy them. They cost, you know, like 3 months' wages or whatever. And you didn't need to saddle them up, and they didn't require upkeep. And the first wave of feminism really was pushed by this sartorial insult of women wearing bifurcated garments, which were known as bloomers. And finding their own time, you know, and traveling way beyond their own town. They'd go, like, two towns over and not be served when they try to go to a roadhouse and order up a little lunch or something or a beer because they were unchaperoned. And so there were, like, laws that had to be changed and all this stuff. And that led to, you know, like, the 70-year fight to get the vote in 1920. And I saw an analogy between me freeing the women and the bicycle freeing the women back in the day,
mm-hmm.
That I wanted to forge, you know, like a more concrete conscious. It's not like by accident. I definitely want to take credit for like an artistic grafting of women's cycling and women's lib history being enacted every time a woman throws her leg over the bike now. And like she's taking part in history now. We're going to have Roe versus Wade overturned, and we're going to have to fight again. Like, these things come in cycles, and we have to be strong, and the bicycle is going to help us be strong. But motorists hate bicyclists. And so if you're scared of angry motorists, as anybody who's been the passenger in a car with somebody with road rage knows, you better ride in the dirt. However, the dirt didn't appeal to women. Since I was, like, almost the only racer, it must be because women don't like doing this. And I go, no, it's because they've got other hurdles. They're taking care of their family, or they're scared, or they believe you about how dangerous it is. So I go, hey, it's easy, safe, and fun, and no cars. And by the way, I'll serve you hot tea and a great cheese Danish from Fred Heitman's Bakery, bread and butter. I mean, bread and chocolate, or whatever. I think he called it bread and chocolate. Anyway, yeah, free, for all the free Danish you want, and just, like, we'll never even think about our thighs, our hair, our, you know, 72 cents for every dollar a guy makes. You just get out in the woods, you eat, drink, make friends, bond, have a great time, come home. And then, you know, in a year you bring your bike in and the bike guy goes, you actually ride this thing. And then you go, I think I need to go to a new shop. obviously they can't believe that I actually ride this thing. So wombats, through the newsletter, were like dinging sexist shops and applauding less sexist shops. And I'd get shops to pay $100 to have a mention in the newsletter. And
did you write the newsletter?
Yeah, with all these phony names, you know, Anita Beer and Carmen Denominator.
Anita Beer and Carmen Denominator.
Just silly, you know, like so that the names look a little different on the bylines.
Yes, that's funny.
Gloria Stitz. Anyway, wombats burgeoned. This is before social media. I was the person turning all the women onto each other. We had a
and this is in
phone
Marin
list.
County.
It was in Marin County, but it quickly grew to, you know, New Mexico.
Phone
LA.
List. How long is your phone list?
Well, I got up to about 800 or 900 names.
Oh,
it was
my.
Kind of a hassle, but somebody who worked at Fireman Fund did the Xeroxing for free for me. Thank you very much, Lynn. Don't want to out her, though. She's probably retired by now. But the women that met in those first two or three different pods of wombats, they all stuck together. And sometimes they'd resent newcomers because they were slow. And I go, well, I went slow for you. You know, like, this club is aimed at the frightened.
The inclusiveness.
Well, it was for scaredy cat beginners. Because it's easy and safe out there. It's not dangerous. Of course, when you get better and better, you seek more complex challenges, which is called technical riding. And it is fun. I certainly got better and finally enjoyed the rides Charlie used to like to take me on, and I couldn't do them very well. And I was, you know, ending up kind of fighting because it was just too damn hard. But after years and years of racing, I'd do some of the rides with Charlie around the backside of Lake Kent Lake, or not Kent Lake, but Alpine Lake. There's something called Helen Mark Trail, and it's very technical and hard and vertical. And once I was strong and skilled, then it was like, oh, I get it. This is fun because I'm better at riding. And so to be able to hand, you know, like basically pick up the backside of the canvas tent that's the boys' club, and, you know, the bicycle world is a boys' club. I ushered a lot of women in and tried to model being generous to other women rather than refusing to speak the way the roadies were with me. They were really unkind, except for Liz Newberry and Cindy White Oliveri. And I wanted to model a different behavior. And also being the, you know, for years, the champ, basically to some people that was proof that women will never, the women's side's never going to grow because there's no women interested. And I go, no, there's all these other invisible social hurdles. And you guys aren't taking care of them. And all your ads are so sexist. It's disgusting. You know, why are you using, for Marzocchi brakes or shocks, these bondage and discipline rubber clad women models in your ads or like the 12 women in rainbow-colored thongs looking over their shoulder for I can't remember which tire maker, but it was just so gross.
Just like the garage calendars.
Yes, the girly calendars. And I actually issued awards for them. The most sexist got the golden testicle. The next best was the silver testicle. And the third was the bronze. And I would mail a letter of congratulations to GT Bicycles for their sexist ads and Diamondback for their more balls, more beef, more bike, whatever. I mean, I figured since you can't complain because women are famous for being, you know, whatever. There's no such thing as a feminist comedian. You've probably heard that, too. You know, like, they're not funny. Those women are not funny. Well, of course, we're fucking furious. But amongst ourselves, we're goddamn hilarious. And to me, to cite an affront and give it a prize was way cooler than complaining about it. Because then they can frame
it. What was
it.
The reception?
I never heard back from any of them.
Stonewalled.
I wasn't stonewalled. I didn't go, hey, how'd you like
it? No, did they? They stonewalled.
Well, I would hear years later through the grapevine that it's up on the wall or whatever. You know. But they people knew Jackie, and they knew what her feminist thing was. And it was, you know, kind of like she's just crank. And but I'm happy to say that most of the women that were in Wombats had no idea that I had been a racing champion. That did not come into play. It was just not an issue. I was their mom showing them how it's done, being a mother hen. And then later they might find out that I was a racing champ, but it's a good thing because a lot of gals won't try something if they're intimidated by the person trying to talk them into doing it. And if I could have been black and maybe 40 pounds heavier, it would have been even cooler to, A, keep up with the guys and be in their races and not get dropped. And lesbian, you know, like if I could just be three or four more, what do you call them, versions of diversity, layers of otherness, that would have been even cooler. But I'm stuck with being, you know, having all the privileges accruing to being a white, educated woman. So I take my, you know, my otherness where I can, which is in my X chromosome, and work it as much as I can. And also, I don't want to be, you know, part of consumer culture. So that's something I protest against. And I came into biking from riding my bike as a gesture of respect for the earth rather than, like, as a sport. And so I call it a pastime because I'm really not, like, a professional athlete. I'm just a supercharged eco fiend that, you know, never uses a piece of paper towel or toilet paper only one time. It's got to get used at least two or three times. First, you know, blow your nose or cry, and then use it, you know, to wipe yourself in the toilet or something. I have been dumpster diving for food for 15 years because I feel sorry for all the food getting thrown away. Basically, I'm trying to not make a great, huge, you know, whatever, consumer footprint if I can. And yet, now, thanks to Charlie's brain injury 3 years ago, I ride, I'm around in a car, and I just like, sorry, planet. I did my best, and I gave my very, you know.
So let's talk about that. You've been with Charlie for now.
Since 82.
So we are talking about 37 years.
Years.
Yes.
So, a long time.
And he went on to have a career as a bike manufacturer with
builder. I would say builder. An artisanal builder and a founder of a company called Wilderness Trail Bikes, which then he was swindled out of by Patrick Seiler and Mark Slate. He and Steve Potts lost everything, including the building they bought, 475 Miller. That was an ugly chapter, and Charlie really, he gave up bike frame building during the tenure of growing Wilderness Trail Bikes, all the while not understanding how Patrick and Mark were stealing the company from them. And as soon as he became aware of, he tried really hard to get them into Alcoholics Anonymous and whatever other anonymouses there are for drug use, because they're very into their drugs. And there was a giant split between Potts and Charlie and Slate and whatever. And so Charlie finally, after a year working for free for one whole year to try to save the company and get new, you know, like CEOs from other companies to come help WTB move up, but they would all stomp out in a huff because Patrick would never let them look at any of the numbers, any of the actual figures, because he was carrying on fraudulent behavior, you know. And then when Charlie, it turned into a lawsuit where they tried to litigate to get their one quarter each, and they didn't succeed, but the 475, they... Secretary was shredding for weeks, shredding, getting rid of all kinds of evidence so that nothing could be subpoenaed and stuff. They came out with their skin. Charlie emerged being still the owner of our house. He had lent our house for a second mortgage to that business, and Seidler stopped paying the mortgage so in hopes that it would be put up for foreclosure and sold to some friend of his on the courthouse steps. So,
ouch.
It was... and it happened to coincide with my having breast cancer. So, and Charlie's parents aged about 10 years during this. It's the only time I'd ever seen Charlie cry. He emerged and he never had anything more to do with the bike world. And then about 5 years later, after doing freelance machining for people that want jet engines improved or something, he's like somehow sought out and found, because he is quite the machinist genius, creative guy. A couple of friends bore down on him to build them one last bike. And so he revved up the heat treating oven and made himself a bike and four other rabid collectors that first they all paid Steve Potts to make the bike that Charlie would design. But since Steve never actually came forth with the bike, they leaned on Charlie, and he's a gentleman, so he caves rather than just like, I told you, you know, I'll design the bike, but Potts has to make it. But Potts, I know you guys are really good friends, but he's sort of incapacitated. It's a miracle he even gets bikes out, but he definitely did not build any bikes for those four or five collectors. And I don't know if he ever gave them back their money either. But Charlie was like sort of pressured into making them some bikes, and they were very fine machines. And then he was on his way to making me one bike because he was raving about his road bike that had slightly different geometry from the 1950s, from the French constructeurs. They're longer road bikes and better for touring, long hours in the saddle, where almost all the road bikes manufactured here by mainstream companies, they're made for racing criterium, and so they're too steep. So if you don't want that kind of bike, you have to have a handmade bike by some guy that'll take suggestions from you and use their know-how. So Charlie began doing that, and right in the middle of finishing the fork, he went out on a 45-minute ride in August 2015 and crashed and burned. And I was in Vermont learning Japanese because there was a race I wanted to go to in Japan. Then I got the word that he was in the hospital, so I flew home, and he was all broken but fine from the neck up. And the next 7 weeks, as his bones healed, he seemed fine, and then he had a killer headache September 16th or so, and they raced him by ambulance with sirens blaring from Marin to Redwood City. He told me about it when he got there. Hey, the sirens going and everything. And the neurologist or whoever, the brain people, were freaking because his brain had a closed head injury bleed, and it was...
Subdermal hematoma.
Yeah. That's called the Mount Fuji sign because there's blood on two sides and one little peak or something.
And so the brain, the pressure builds and builds and builds and starts damaging cells in the brain.
Right. And remember my dysfunctional family and my youngest brother being in arrears? He never saw any of those radiology screens.
So after Charlie's accident,
it was quiescent until just before I went to Japan. Redwood City said that, you know, you have a choice. You can do brain surgery or take...
So there was a slow bleed, in other words.
It was fine, and then it suddenly began bleeding. The brain injured brain began bleeding.
He had a concussion.
Right. And the hematoma manifested, and they said you can take steroids or do relieve the pressure by surgery. And we chose the wrong one. We said steroids. We should have said drill, drill, drill. And I was encouraged to, you know, like, yeah, you can still go to Japan. So I made sure to take Charlie to the good earth, and because he still had some broken, like he had a broken collarbone, five broken ribs, and a broken pubic bone. No leg bones and no arm bones, but the collarbone. So he's going to take care of himself for the month or two that I was going to be in Japan. But I didn't even get to Japan. I got word from a friend that works at Marin General that he had just had emergency brain surgery. And so I flew home, and I reached him at midnight, and he's all tubes and machines. Grabbed his hand and said, "Hey, Charlie, Jackie, if you can hear me, squeeze my hand." And so I felt the squeeze. And I went, "He's not a vegetable!" And they all, "It's midnight at Marin General ICU. Don't wake up the vegetables." So, and that just began a very, very long road to Charlie's brain recovery and my assuming actual responsibility, which I've never wanted to have. I've never wanted to be in charge. And as a control freak, that meant Charlie got to be in charge with no complaining, sometimes bickering, but not, you know, like seizing control or anything. And so, like, once a month I'd write checks. You know, we had to pay our bills and stuff. And everything was sort of... The house was his, not mine, and but I paid all the, you know, shared all the expenses, although bought our own food. And all of a sudden, I'm in charge of a 140-pound infant that can't even walk. So while he was still in the took him from ICU over to a rehabilitation hospital in Vallejo, and where he learned to walk, talk, swallow for 1 month. During that time, my dad died, which was fortuitous. The only thing, there's a lot of good when dad died. One of them was that they kept Charlie in for another week so I could get a ramp built into our house because I wasn't sure he could walk, and a few other things. And then later when my dad's, you know, will was open, he like specifically named all the children as excluded from his will, which was like, wow, that's real parenting. One of my brothers, the one that lives in the truck, he had 1 year of law school, so he's trying to contest it, but it's not going to go anywhere.
So, Charlie.
But back to Charlie. Charlie has been crawling back from the edge of death. He technically died when he took himself to the hospital when I was had just jumped on a plane to go to Japan, and he taxied to Kaiser and then just sat there and turned down all the requests for scans. They should have ignored
it. After his fall.
This is 7 weeks after his fall.
And
after his trip to the brain center in Redwood City, he was now living at home, but he got a second horrible headache, took a taxi, and then denied them doing scans, which they should not have allowed him to deny. So when he got to Marin General, they said, why was he, what is the word, why was he sitting for 7 hours in the ICU, you know, at the emergency room without a scan? Why was he languishing there? Sorry. So anyway, he languished and died, and they dragged him back to health with a doctor here in Marin General. And now we just, you know, like, he one step at a time. He went to speech therapists. He went to 20 different therapists. I drove him all over the place. I didn't sleep. I found a caregiver. We had a live-in for about 2 months, which was kind of intense.
So in short, because we're going to have to wrap up this interview, your life, it seems to me that you've lived in many ways a life of your own making with a lot of freedom.
Right.
You've been strong enough to speak for yourself and exert yourself out there. You've been incredibly robust physically and really, when listening to your story, psychologically and mentally, to forge onward and make your own world. And so you've enjoyed that kind of freedom, and then now you're a caregiver.
Right.
We've socialized. I've watched you with Charlie, who's great. He's doing much, much better.
He can walk and talk, thank God.
But he's not the same as.
No, he's not.
He's not an independent man. Neither are you the same independent woman that you were before.
Well, I was independent because I had this Lexan safety net underneath called Charlie Cunningham, who fixed everything that I broke, repaired every single part of the house. When his injury happened, suddenly I'm in charge of plumbers, electricians, and it seems like everything fell apart right around then. So I had to deal with all these things, and sometimes I did not do a good job because I don't know how to be a foreman. Putting a new roof on his machine shop, for example, I destroyed the machine shop doing so because I didn't. Anyway,
from what I can tell, you've got the support of the biking community
right.
in so many ways.
We do.
And let's close with that.
Sure. It's been quite a fantastic, pleasant surprise how many people I've known that Charlie is beloved. No one hates him. He's because he's this angelic man. He's always been sort of beatific. The journalists always grab those words when they want to describe soft-spoken Charlie Cunningham. It's always what a sweet, kind, and ethereal kind of guy he is. And he's got a very deep spiritual side that's pretty darn nice, and because he's a Sufi, and it doesn't like bring to bear in his daily life in a normal way, but he always was quite comfortable in his skin and didn't care what other people thought and knew his own role in the universe. You know, he really was at peace, and now it's the opposite. He hates his life. He bitterly complains. He misses the old him, and I have to remind him like, well, I'm glad you're not dead. You've made amazing progress. You can kind of read a little bit now. And you're walking independently. He still doesn't have a sense of direction, so he has a memorized route. And I don't think he'll ever drive. He's not even going to ride a bike by himself anymore, although I certainly put him on a bike and had him ride by himself. But he kept steering off the road and going down a cliff because he's got a very, very tiny, narrow band of vision and very poor visual processing and probably some cognitive issues as well. But anyway, he's crawling back. I'm crawling back. I'm assuming responsibility. I'm trying hard not to become like an alcoholic, embittered old, you know, lady. But I always ask people to come visit, and they never do. And we had this massive fundraiser that the Bike Museum produced. They did a beautiful job. And I got to see people that I routinely beg to come visit, and they never do. And I go, well, that counts as a visit, so I won't hear from them for another 3 years. I'm usually the one, like, asking people to come by. And they just don't have time. Like, nobody has time. So mm-hmm. My friend Kay Ryan said, find new friends. And I go, as a 63-year-old woman, I'm going to find friends? Okay, I'll work on it.
But the community is, I mean, I saw there was just a fundraiser.
Yeah, and people adore Charlie. There's a part of me that's kind of convinced that maybe his wife's a tough pill to swallow. You know, I have my own friends, and they love me. But I definitely feel like I'm a thorn in the side of people. Certainly right before his accident, people had to figure out how to get around Jackie to talk to Charlie because I shielded him from the onslaught of people and their needs. They took advantage of him. People, they'd come by at any time of day and just, like, hang out in the shop, and Charlie could never say, hey, oop, look at the time, got to go. So I'd just go in the house and call his phone, and then the phone, you know, I'd go, okay, now if we just pretend to have a nice conversation for a while, the person's finally going to get tired of talking, waiting while you're on the phone because you're busy now, and now they might realize they should go because Charlie was busy, but he never told anybody to get lost.
So
anyway, we have a loving community that I'm not sure I still have this problem with my shitty self-esteem because I'm not easy. I'm not an easy person. I'm still too much. I'm grateful for the help that they give Charlie, and I it is helping me, obviously, because it's actually paying for one caregiver who's actually been out for 2 months, so I've been taking care of Charlie 100% now, and I haven't ridden to Mill Valley in it feels like a year.
I'm glad you rode here today.
Yeah, I miss the, like, comings and goings, but I realized that as I had somehow predicted, I used to say, have dessert first. I made sure to have dessert first. I'll probably have to have broccoli later. And I also said, I'm, you know, never going to have a kid, but I'll probably be assigned one in later life. And so these things sort of came true. And it's not because I wished it to come true. It's just kind of ironic. And it's I guess, strangely ironic that my husband is a brain patient and my dad was a brain patient. And I married Charlie for his brain. We were two very alive minds. The bodies they also appreciated each other in a big way. And I grew to love him more and more the longer we were together. But my habit had been to like dangerous, druggy people like Gary Fisher, who more resembled my father. And it took quite a jump to stay and appreciate a safe, loving man who wasn't so unpredictable. And, you know, I mean, I learned to love Charlie.
And you're learning, it seems that Charlie's
still
helping
learning.
You to
I mean, he's to helping learn me learn to love myself.
If there's one thing in closing I'm going to ask you, you've been a vanguard for women in writing. For young women writers, do you have any advice?
Wow. Well, your sport is not the one I was in. Your sport is a job that you're trying to excel in so you can spare your parents the $500,000 college. You know, it's so if you can, like, try to hold a little bit of an ember for loving the activity before you burn out. That's for the girls who are racing at the top of their game. And there's a Marin girl that's world champion. And she's the first world champion American in 17 years because European girls have support for competing, where here you have to find private sponsorship. We don't have government assistance for athletes the way other countries do. So luckily she had parents that could afford to keep her, right, you know, like in all the right equipment with the good psychologists and all that stuff. And I wonder what she's going to do with her life. And I've tried, like, to hang, you know, like, let her know that I'd love to meet her, but I haven't gotten to yet. I've gotten to see her speak at the museum, but I didn't get to talk with her.
What other advice?
Oh, I don't know if it's advice. I just...
Or lessons learned.
I hope you'll share what you learn with other women and try to be gentle on the planet, because that's what a bicycle is for me. It's not like a path to Olympic glory. It's really saving the planet. Although I certainly wanted to get in the Olympics, and then when they announced mountain biking in the Olympics, I tried to get in. But my mom's brother wouldn't tell me where his mom grew up in Ireland, so I couldn't prove Irish ancestry and get in that way. Yeah, the whole family hates each other, but loving, being loving to your, even maybe your competitors wouldn't hurt if you compete. The bike is this fantastic freedom machine, and I hope you can enjoy it, especially off-road where there really aren't cars and all the same dangers. It's not really advice, because I'm shitty at advice.
I don't know. I think that's good advice. I hope you can love it. When you're talking about this, I'm envisioning the drawing that you made of you in bed with your bike.
Mm. Yeah, the bicycle has so much to give to the world still.
Mm.
Maybe we'll be taken seriously and people will be punished badly for hurting us. Nowadays, it's just like if you said the sun's in your eyes, then you're exonerated, and it doesn't matter if you killed three people.
Hmm. Well... let's close with the. I'm going to close
positive.
With the vision of you and
right.
the bike.
Well,
and the affinity you've had, obviously, from such an early age, and that you've maintained despite all different kinds of life experiences and the challenges you're facing today. And Jackie, I want to say thank you.
Oh, well, thank you
for coming
so much,
and
Deborah.
Sharing. I've learned a lot in this interview. I'm really very grateful that you're sharing your perspective as a woman rider. And particularly at the time that you were competing so much. It's precious information, and I hope that women riders will listen to this, and men as well. I have noticed on the hiking trails, there's a sort of a pleasantries are exchanged now between bikers and hikers, and I see a lot of female riders.
Yeah, that's great.
And that is great.
I have a postscript. I can't be done because I didn't mention anything about my scribbling. And I did support myself with my scribbling throughout my
racing. You're writing, not writing.
Career. Yeah.
Yes.
I say scribbling and pedaling so I don't confuse writing and writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, like, columns in bike magazines and stuff and all kinds of platforms for getting my belief that, you know, there's bias in the prize giving, and so I had a column called Prize and Prejudice.
Prize.
And I'll continue to write. I really hope I put some of this stuff I'm telling you onto paper. I really struggle with why won't I write? I've had 3.5 years of, like, all the time in the world, and I haven't done it. But
well,
that's
to
my
be
postscript.
Continued.
Yeah,
that's
is
your
to be
postscript.
Continued.
And
thank you.
Who knows what the future brings? But
right. We
keep on pedaling.
Rightio.
Right to it.
Right. Oh, I've got the advice. Look where you want to go. Try not to look where you don't want to go. Like, for me, it's trying not to imagine that everybody's driving with on their phone or looking at their dashboard computer. Try to banish the thought and see myself moving in a golden cloud of good luck. And there is a bike thing about you tend to go where you're looking. And so if you really don't like the direction you're going, you better rip your eyes off and look exactly where you want to go, and your bike will follow. So there's my advice. Sorry.
A perfect closer.
I'm gonna have to patch it in.
You got it in there.
Okay.
And that's a beautiful way to end this interview.
All righty.
So on behalf of the Mill Valley Public Library and the Mill Valley Historical Society, this concludes our interview. Thank you.
Thank you.